What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest? Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who are perhaps not a Catholic, but you've still got a question about the Catholic faith that you'd really like the answer to. Well, that's why we are here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205 271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Those of you watching on TV today, you can participate as well. Here's our email address for you folks, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer. Vanessa Sanchez is our call screener today. We also have Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you so much.
Glad to hear that. We're going to lead off with an interesting question from Nilsa. Nilsa says, are the older catechisms, like the Baltimore Catechism, still valid?
Sure. I appreciate the question. So, the word valid is a bit of a strange choice because it's not like, validity is a concept we usually apply to the sacraments to determine whether or not they have all the conditions necessary for the sacrament to actually be the thing that Christ designed it to be.
Yes.
You know, I think a better way of putting it would be to say, are those catechisms still useful?
Okay.
Are they still useful?
All right.
And, of course, they can be useful. I mean, the Baltimore Catechism is sort of the American adaptation of the Roman Catechism or the Catechism of the Council of Trent. And after the Council of Trent, the Pope and the Council Fathers decided they needed to produce a catechism that would accurately reflect the decrees and dogmas of the Council, and they produced the Roman Catechism, and then that was used to produce local catechisms like the Baltimore.
Okay.
Well, the dogmas of Trent are still the dogmas of the Church. They haven't stopped being the dogmas of the Church, and I personally find it extremely helpful to occasionally peruse. I don't read the Baltimore Catechism myself regularly. I go straight to the Roman Catechism, which was prepared by the Council at the Pope's insistence, and it gives a kind of helpful summary of the conclusions of the Council, and sometimes it elaborates them in very interesting ways. I particularly like the Roman Catechism's discussion of the sacrament of the Eucharist and the sacrifice of the Mass. So I get a lot of value out of that personally. And it's got a different tone to it than the Catechism of the Catholic Church that was promulgated under Pope John Paul II, and has slightly different emphases, sometimes significantly different emphases. And so I use that to sort of enrich my own understanding of the faith. However, and there's a big however, if you are a bishop in the world today and you are responsible for catechesis in your diocese, it is the law, right? It's not an option. You don't have a choice in the matter. You are required to regard the Catechism of the Catholic Church as the authoritative norm that should guide catechesis in your diocese, right? And so if you go look at, say, Catholic curriculum providers that are producing their own catechetical materials, they must, they should, they ought to, and they have to produce those with the Catechism of the Catholic Church as the norm, because it reflects, yes, the teaching of the Council of Trent and all of the councils, but also the doctrine of the Second Vatican Council, which is the doctrine of the Church, right? And so you wouldn't want to cut off the catechism that John Paul gave us, and not regard that. But you can certainly enrich your understanding with these older catechisms as well.
Nilsa, thanks so much for your email. We have a big word coming up here, David. This is from Michael. Is it okay to pray the rosary in a way like hesychasm?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So people are asking, well, what is hesychasm? Right? So hesychasm is a tradition of Eastern spirituality. It's part of the Orthodox tradition, the Eastern Catholic tradition. And there are some thinkers in the Latin Catholic Church that aren't real big fans of hesychasm, but the magisterium recognizes that this is a legitimate form of Catholic spirituality that's practiced by the Eastern Church. Doesn't mean that, you know, Catholics West and East can't sometimes have little arguments about what's better. And so you'll find some people that'll give you a little pushback. But in terms of the magisterium, yeah, it's okay to, certainly okay to practice that, even if you're a Latin Catholic. Can you adapt the rosary to that? I suppose you could, sort of mixing apples and oranges, but yeah.
Okay, very good. And here's one from Bert who says, I am a catechism teacher. I want the students to learn the Mass. Would it be all right if I greet them by saying, the Lord be with you, and then having them respond with, and with your spirit?
You know, if the purpose is to teach them the responses, and what you're trying to do here is rehearse the parts of the Mass that call for the laity to verbally engage, I see nothing objectionable about that. If you're somehow taking on the persona of the celebrant of the Mass and trying to project yourself that way, or if you do it in a fashion that might confuse in the minds of the students the distinction between clergy and laity, well, then I think that would be, not as helpful, right? Because
it's
very important for them to understand that the ministerial priest is the celebrant, and that there are parts of the Mass that are designated only for the priest, and the laity are to respond to what he does. And so, yeah, as long as your goal is pedagogical here, and hey, I'm not really a priest, but I'm gonna stand in, as if I were, just as an exercise, so you can learn these responses. I got no problem with that. Just but don't. Don't start pretending to be a priest.
No, we don't want that. Bert, thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We try to tackle two or three of these emails on each of our programs, and then once a month or so, we'll do a mailbag show, and we'll answer a whole bunch of emails. Again, the address, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, the phone lines are open. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, we are ready for you. 833-288-EWTN is that number, 833-288-3986, or if you prefer, text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a moment with lots more Call to Communion here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Here's something you may or may not know. EWTN has its very own YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. Best of all, it is absolutely free. Every day, we add new radio and TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to our YouTube channel. So when you go to YouTube, search EWTN. That'll take you to our channel, and you will be good to go. A few moments ago, I mentioned a question that had a big word. I've got two big words for you this time, David. This is from Joe, watching us on YouTube, just sent this in to us. Can you explain the difference between infralapsarianism and supralapsarianism? And why do Calvinists say that Aquinas and Augustine were Calvinists because of these views?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate the question. Well, I'm going to answer the second one first and then the first one.
Okay.
Calvinists say Aquinas and Augustine were Calvinists because they don't know that much about Aquinas and Augustine,
okay,
and they're eager to press them in service polemically to serve their own aims, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's one thing that Aquinas and Augustine were not, it was Calvinists, all right? So let's explain the difference. And part of me is like, well, do we have to really? All right, it's been a very long time since I've had to think about these concepts, and I am so glad that they're no longer part of my theological repertoire. This is something that is drawn from a non-Catholic tradition. It's language that's drawn from 17th century Reformed, that is to say Calvinistic Protestantism, and it really doesn't characterize the way Catholics do theology at all. And like I said, I used to live in that camp back when I was Presbyterian, and I'm so glad to be Catholic now and to be done with all of that, that I don't have to think these thoughts anymore. But here's what it boils down to. So as many people know, one characteristic of John Calvin's thought and of the tradition that bears his name is a very heavy emphasis on the biblical doctrine of predestination. But Calvin meant something pretty specific about that, and a little bit, well, in some respects, very different from what Catholics mean by the same term. You know, in Calvin's view, God decides before the foundation of the earth that he will infallibly bring certain people to salvation. But here's the real kicker, that he's going to also reprobate others. Right, so there's a positive divine decree before the creation of the world to create human beings for the specific purpose of damning them, and that is not the Catholic position at all. Right, but that was characteristic of the Calvinist, and there were Calvin himself didn't get into these terms, but some of his heirs, you know, 100 years later, 200 years later, started to try to think through the logic of this, and a debate that really doesn't reflect the Bible, I think, at all, or the mind of the biblical authors. And certainly not Christian spirituality, but it is a speculative question within Reformed theology. And that's this. Does God sort of in the abstract, as it were, sit around thinking one day, gee, I think I'd like to create some people to damn them. and then, you know, in order to do that, what I'll do is I'll create a world and I'll allow them to fall into sin. Ooh, that'll be a great way to damn them, right? So I want to damn people. Then I want to create the conditions whereby damnation becomes a viable response, right?
Wow.
And similarly, I'd like to create some people to bring to eternal glory. How will I do that? I know. I'll create the same world in which those poor souls are going to be damned, but I'll create an opportunity for them to be saved, right? So first, God has the intent to save or damn. Then he actually ordains the fall of man. He decrees the fall of man as the occasion whereby he can then affect grace or glory or damnation in those that he's already antecedently decided to save or damn. All right. And that position is called supralapsarianism, supra meaning above the fall.
Uh-huh.
Right. So prior to the fall, God's already worked out in his mind, you know, I'm going to create Tom Price there and just for the specific purpose of watching him sizzle, right? And then I'll come across, then I'll invent the means later, right? The infralapsarian position, or some call the postlapsarian position, takes the other view that God first decrees the fall, all right, and then the salvation or damnation of the human race, right? Now, you know, a Catholic looks at all of this and like puts his fingers in his ears and goes, ah, right, because it's just so not the way Catholics think,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and so Are Augustine and Aquinas supra or infralapsarian? Neither. Like this is a complete category mistake. It's like, I don't know. It's like asking if they're Van Halen fans. Like it's like the question does not arise.
No,
you know?
No.
So what Aquinas and Augustine did do is they did think a lot about the doctrine of God's providence.
Uh-huh.
And because Scripture talks about predestination, they talk about predestination. But I mean, again, this is a biblical doctrine. What they mean by predestination is God's determination to give the grace necessary for salvation to those whom he foreknows will be saved, all right? And it implies a very pretty strong doctrine of providence, but they're very explicit that God does not intend and cause the damnation of the wicked, right? So Aquinas will use the word reprobation, which Reformed use to mean, you know, God's decision before all time to pick somebody out to toast, mm-hmm. right? Aquinas doesn't use it that way. He uses the word reprobation to mean God permitting some people not to be saved, right? And well, it's evident that some people are not saved,
sure.
right? And if God's providence is in control of reality, then, you know, God must permit that for some inscrutable reason, right? But it's far removed from the kind of metaphysical logic chopping that the Reformed are doing, okay?
Yeah.
And there's so many ways in which the Calvinist tradition is just vastly different from the Thomistic tradition or the Augustinian tradition. I'll name a few, right? So one is that, and this is really incredibly important, is that the Reformed tradition teaches that The human race is so deformed, so vitiated by sin, that even with the help of grace, it is impossible for a soul to do anything meritorious. So the greatest saint that you could possibly imagine is actually sort of damnably wicked in the eyes of God, according to the Reformed tradition. It's called the doctrine of total depravity. And neither Aquinas nor Augustine believe that at all. They definitely think that grace reforms the character and enables us to merit eternal life, right? The Reformed tradition teaches that you're saved by faith alone, mm-hmm. right? Since you can't possibly ever do anything good, God simply acquits you and counts you as if you were righteous. And that comes about through faith alone. And that, again, it comes about simply by God's predetermination. You can't do anything to thwart or resist that. And that once God zaps you, so to speak, with his forgiving grace, that you're in no matter what you do, right? Mm. And you can have an infallible certainty of that election. That later Calvinists at Westminster would make the claim that the elect can know for sure. They can have an infallible certainty that they're elect. So you make an act of faith, have some sort of illumination of conscience, and then regardless of what you do, you know, I'm safe from here on out. I'm absolutely and infallibly going to go to heaven when I die. And none of that is true of the Catholic system. None of that's true of Aquinas. None of that's true of Augustine. They think that you can resist grace. They think that grace can be lost. They think that you can't possibly know with certainty that you're one of the elect, i.e. one of the ones that is definitely going to be saved. They do think that you need grace to persevere and that you can pray and ask God for grace and he can give you that grace. But essentially, persevering means you've got to hang on till the end. It doesn't mean that God guarantees you'll hang on. You've got to do the hanging on with God's help. And you certainly don't know for sure, right? So you don't. One of the most pernicious things about the Reformed tradition, in my judgment, is the tendency that it's infused into all of Protestantism to sort of regard the world as set into two camps: me and my set, and then all those other guys. And you know, we're the ones that know for sure, and all you poor benighted souls out there don't. And it really it kind of inculcates a sort of hubris, right, about the way you engage reality. And I know it did in me when I was Reformed. And the Catholic view is much more like, you know, we all need God's grace to be saved, and here it is given to us in the Catholic faith. But I don't know who's got that and who doesn't, and it's not for me to judge. It's God that judges consciences, not I that judges conscience, at least of all myself, right?
Sure, sure.
So I'm going to maintain an attitude of humble and hopeful expectation and rely on the mercy of God and strive to do his will. So the disposition towards reality of the Catholic and the Reformed person towards God's grace and towards the Christian life is just very, very different, right?
Yeah.
And but again, of course, these guys were always citing Augustine because they wanted to enlist him in aid of their project, which I think was quite illegitimate.
Joe, thanks for watching us on YouTube. Glad to define those two eight-syllable words there, and glad that you're listening to us today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're glad that everybody's listening to us. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. We have a couple lines open. You can jump in right now. We got a call from, let's see, looks like David driving through Southern Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. David says, my brother has brought up the idea that Luke and Mark have plagiarized Matthew. Is this true, and did they use the Q source?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So far and away, the vast majority of New Testament scholars, vast majority,
mm-hmm.
hold the theory of Markan priority, the idea that Mark is the earliest gospel,
okay,
and that Matthew and Luke heavily, heavily borrow from the Gospel of Mark. And there are good textual arguments to be made for that position, right? And so Luke and Matthew include some material that's not in Mark,
mm-hmm.
and some of that material is common to Luke and Matthew. So it seems that Luke and Matthew have access to a source other than St. Mark that we don't have access to.
No.
It may have just been a set of oral traditions that were handed down. Maybe it was a document, probably wasn't a document, probably just was a tradition of oral recitation of the teachings of Jesus. And that source has come to be known in scholarly circles as Q, which is short for the German word Quelle, which means source.
It's
the source is what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can actually, if you can go online and look up, Q, and you will find sort of scholarly reproductions of what they imagine the content of Q actually was, independent of the Synoptic Gospels, and
uh-huh.
you can see that content. And then there's some material in Mark. Excuse me. There's some material in Matthew that is in neither Luke or Mark, and there's some in Luke that's in neither Matthew or Mark. And so these New Testament scholars are incredibly creative types. So the stuff that's just in Luke, they call that L.
Okay.
And the stuff that's just in Matthew is M, right? And then the stuff that's in common between those two, they call Q. And then there's Mark that's in common with all of them. So that's by and large the dominant theory. There are, you know, a handful of scholars that have argued for Matthean priority. I think the weight of the evidence and certainly the consensus is for Mark in priority. And then John's doing his own thing.
It occurs to me that the James Bond movies also had Q and M. Do you suppose there's a connection there?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Maybe. Appreciate that. And thanks so much for your call listening to St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Richard in Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, Richard. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I'm a cradle Catholic, and I'm struggling a little bit with, since COVID, the blood of Christ is not being shared at many churches. I'm struggling with that because Jesus offered both his body and blood. And it's also, when the priest, shares that moment with us. Can you hear me well?
Yes, we hear you well.
When you offer the bread and the wine, it converts it into the body and blood, and he says, take all of you this.
Okay.
And yet the priest shares it, the deacon shares it, and us laymen don't get to enjoy it.
Yes, okay. Thank you. I really appreciate the question. So let me clarify a few things in your question. You may not have meant exactly the language you use, but you said that when they are offered, they are converted. Those are the terms you use. When the bread and wine are offered, they are converted into the body and blood of Christ. I'm not sure what you mean there by the word offer, but if you're suggesting that they become for us the body and blood of Christ at the moment they are offered in Holy Communion to the lay faithful, that is not the teaching of the Church, right? So just to clarify, what the Church teaches, it is at the words of consecration when the priest says, this is my body, this is the chalice of the new covenant in my blood. It's at that moment that the elements become for us the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus, not at the moment they're offered in communion, but at the moment at which they are consecrated upon the altar.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, I want to talk about the reason that it matters. Like, why does it matter that we have the body and blood, soul, and divinity of Christ in Holy Communion, or in the consecrated elements? And why does it matter that there are two kinds? If you think about it, Jesus could have given us a sacrament of communion in just one kind. He could have just given us bread, or he could have just given us wine. Why did he do two? And intuitively, the question seems to suggest, well, you know, we need two because we need something to eat and something to drink. And that would make sense. It's just not the right answer, right? There is another reason why Christ gave us two kinds. And it's because in every sacrament, you have the reality of the thing, Christ's body and blood, but you also have, in addition to the reality, you do have a symbol. You have a sign that signifies and teaches.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Holy Communion, in the case of the consecrated host and the consecrated chalice, what's being signified is that Christ's body and blood have been separated from one another, and that occurred at Calvary at his death. And so the reason for the double consecration of bread and wine is not so we can have drink with our food. It's to show forth or memorialize the death of Christ at Calvary. Now hold that thought. We got to come back to this after the break.
Yeah, we do have more to say on this. We'll also talk with Leslie in Celeste, Texas. Got a couple of questions here outstanding on YouTube. We'll get to those as well. And the phone lines are still open for you at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. Hey, glad you're with us for Call to Communion here on EWTN. We do have a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 888-3986. Before the break, we were talking with Richard in Charleston, South Carolina. He was curious about the precious blood not being offered so often, which actually opened up a larger question, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Because so a lot of people have this question, and I think a lot of times it emerges from the sense that they're being denied something essential in the sacrament if they don't partake of the chalice at Holy Communion. And so to answer that really adequately, I think we have to get our heads wrapped around the question, why is there a chalice in the first place? Mm-hmm. What is it there for? And it's not just so we can have something to eat and drink, right? That there's actually a profound symbol, and don't freak out at the word symbol being applied to the Eucharist. The Church teaches that there is a symbolic thing going on in addition to the real presence.
Uh-huh.
And what's being represented in the Eucharist is the death of Christ at Calvary. And that's why we have two kinds. While we have bread over here, wine over there, body and blood, to show forth or memorialize what took place at Calvary. And that's in the language of the Mass itself, the priest actually says this memorial of Christ's death and resurrection. He uses that language to describe what's going on. And after memorializing Calvary, the priest and the whole congregation, that's very important to keep in mind, the whole congregation together, collectively, offer those elements, bread and wine, which have become body and blood, soul and divinity.
Yes.
They offer those consecrated elements to God as an act of sacrifice. Now, it's an unbloody sacrifice. Jesus is not actually killed again. He only died once. Mm-hmm. But we make an unbloody offering. And that's why the priest prays, you know, Lord, look upon this offering.
Yeah.
And why he says, you know, pray, my brothers and sisters, that your sacrifice and mine may be acceptable. Like, it is first and foremost a rite, R-I-T-E, a rite of sacrifice that the Church partakes in. And the Second Vatican Council is extremely clear, and for that matter, so is the Council of Trent, that it is not just the priest at the altar who offers the sacrifice. It is the whole congregation that together with him offer the immaculate victim, that is Jesus, to God the Father for the reparation of our sins. And in doing so, in enacting that ritual sacrifice, we are seeking to assimilate the meaning of that into our own lives so that we ourselves become sacrificial offerings. St. Paul says, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is your spiritual act of worship. And that's why the Eucharist is the spiritual act of worship of the Church. The reason it's source and summit, this is what the Second Vatican Council taught, the reason it's source and summit is not simply because we receive Christ in Holy Communion, but because we participate in the act of his sacrifice. Mm. That's what makes it source and summit. So now, given all that, if I go to Holy Mass and I don't commune at all, I receive neither the consecrated host nor the chalice, have I been deprived participation in the Eucharist? The Church says no. In fact, if I'm there with the proper participation, I am fully engaged in both the consecration of the host and the consecration of the chalice by offering these elements and myself along with the priest to God the Father, even if I don't commune. So I'm not deprived of anything. I'm intimately connected to the sacrificial act. Now, the act of communing is sort of the culmination of this act of oblation, right? And as communion, the Council of Trent says, the act of sacrifice, the act of communion are very different. As communion, what's conveyed to me is body, blood, soul, and divinity, and that comes either in the host or in the chalice. And what's taught, remember, there's both the reality and then the sign, what's taught is Christ's nearness to me. Obviously, it's not just taught, it's affected,
sure.
But it is being communicated to me cognitively that Christ has come close to me. That's the significance of the consumption of the consecrated host. And that end is fully satisfied if I receive in only one kind. If what I'm trying to communicate to myself is literally Christ's nearness, and I get all of Christ under either consecrated species, then I have all of Christ. There's nothing lacking to me there, right? And there's a prudent reason to withhold the chalice from the laity, and it's got nothing to do with germs. It has to do with the risk of scandal, because let's just be frank, liquids are easier to spill and harder to clean than solids. And so it happens frequently that when the chalice is offered to the laity, that they, well, you know, some two-year-old in communion lying on his parents' hip knocks the thing over, right? And that is a scandal we want to avoid. So because of that, it was the practice in the Western Church for a good 1,000 years that the laity didn't commune at all, except at Easter, and then only in one kind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we're really not deprived.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Richard?
It's very helpful. You know, I know you're limited on time, but I do want to make a point. I think about four Gospels, Jesus says, you must eat, you know, my body and my blood. And then also, to your point, if it's just the body that could serve as the communion, then why does the priest and the deacon consume the blood?
Sure,
and not
sure,
the rest of the congregation.
Sure. So first of all, in the accounts of the institution that we read in the Gospels, in the upper room, there were no lay people present. That's why on Holy Thursday, and Holy Thursday in Easter season, at the beginning of the Triduum, that is actually the feast of the institution of the sacred priesthood. And, you know, they do the foot washing ceremony and all of that, right? We celebrate the institution of the priesthood at that Mass because in addition to giving us the Eucharist, he also ordains the apostles as priests, right, who have this power to sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
And so it's dangerous to look at the descriptions of the sacraments in the Gospels and conclude that they stand for us as a kind of determinative, like definitive rubric for how to celebrate the sacraments, right? In point of fact, there's no text of the Bible anywhere that describes to us how exactly we are to go about celebrating the sacrament. There's a reference to the sacraments.
Yes.
They indicate the sacraments, but they don't actually describe in detail how you do the thing.
Okay.
For that, you must, there's no other way to do it. You must have recourse to sacred tradition. You have to supplement the biblical text with what we know from tradition, right? Because the text just doesn't answer these questions, doesn't raise them, doesn't answer them.
Right.
And to try to read those questions into the text is to make the text say more than it does, right? Now, as to why the priest communes at the altar, well, because as I mentioned earlier, that the act of communing is sort of the culmination of the act of sacrifice. Now, here's something that we are very unfamiliar with because we're 21st century people. But in the ancient world, animal sacrifice was everywhere, it was ubiquitous. So much so that you could not go into a meat market in public and buy a steak without it having been offered to some god in sacrifice.
Wow.
And that's why St. Paul, in the letter to the 1 Corinthians, he has this long discussion about whether or not Christians can eat meat. And it's not because he's a vegan, right? That's got nothing to do with it. It has no concern, like, for the health of humans or the ethics of slaughtering animals. That's not his concern at all. The concern is whether or not you can eat something that's been sacrificed to a pagan god, right? And if you, not only in paganism, but in the Jewish religion, right? The temple in Jerusalem, they're sacrificing animals all the time, constantly, constantly, constantly. You'll read the descriptions of those sacrifices in the Old Testament. And what happens is the worshiper would bring an animal and offer it in sacrifice. And it's very specific that for the thing to be completed, the priest has got to eat it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the rite, right?
Okay.
And then the person who's bringing the offering would also bring some home, and he'd feed it. You know, he'd have a kind of a little party there, and his group that came with him, they'd have some meat too, right? But the eating was part of the completion of the sacrificial rite.
Wow.
And so that's why.
Okay. Appreciate that, Richard. Thanks so much for your call today from Charleston. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Leslie now in Celeste, Texas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio Network. Hey, Leslie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, y'all. I wanted to ask about the concept of God's mercy, and also in relation to the Sacrament of Reconciliation, because a lot of times, especially since I've taken my faith more seriously, I'll be sitting around, I'll think of something what I did when I was 14 that I'm very ashamed of. And these have to do with relationships. I know I've hurt people. But when I've been to the confessional, I don't always remember those from my younger time, because I'm 67. And I feel very, very sad that I've hurt people so badly. And I know that hurts Christ. And so, of course, I immediately confess it then to Christ, but Can you tell me about the concept of God's mercy? Sometimes it feels overwhelming.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So first of all, with respect to the sacrament, rest assured that all of the sins you've ever committed prior to your last confession are forgiven in that confession unless you have intentionally withheld them from the priest. So everybody has this experience of going to confession, doing your best to make a decent confession. You walk away, and then a day later, you're like, oh, yeah, how did I not ever confess that thing I did when I was 14? I'll tell you a story from my past. I unwittingly vandalized a truck.
What?
Yeah, when I was a kid, because in my naivete, I actually genuinely thought that it was an abandoned vehicle. I didn't think that it belonged to anyone.
Okay.
And, you know, something about like pre-adolescent boys, if you give them opportunities to either A, set something on fire, or B, break glass.
Yeah.
And they're all over it, man. And I was like, oh, this would be fun to like smash up these windows, you know, and I smashed them up with some buddies and walked away. And it was kind of like in the middle of nowhere, you know. And then, and it was like 20 years later, it struck me, I went, I don't think that thing was abandoned.
Wow.
I think it was parked.
Well,
you know,
there's a difference.
it was parked out of the way, but I think that was parked.
Ouch.
Right? And I went, and I have no idea like how to track down who that was or how to make reparation for it at all.
Course,
you know, and
yeah.
I was like, I'm a terrible human being. You know, and I went to my confessor and I was like, you know, I did this thing, and he's like, Anders, you and your scruples, you know. But he absolved me, and I moved on with my life. You know, so I get that. I relate to that.
Okay.
But it's forgiven. It is forgiven if you make a good confession, make an effort to make a good confession. So the question, well, should I bring it up in my next confession? And here, I think there are two considerations, right? One is that, well, it's bothering you.
Yeah.
And look, it's not the principal reason we go to confession, but going to confession is cathartic.
Sure it is.
Right? It's cathartic, so you'll feel better afterwards. So I'd say go ahead and bring it up, not because you have to in order to go to heaven, but it'll be useful to you, right? Here's another reason to do it. Whenever you go to confession, it's humiliating. I mean, it just is. Let's just be frank. It's just humiliating. Well, last time I checked, humility was a good thing in the Christian life.
It is.
You know? And so, actively facing up to what you've done wrong and taking responsibility for it, even if it's in a sort of minor way, right? It's just good for you as a habit in life. And the more discomfort you face in doing it in the confessional, the more vigorous you'll be in your actual relationships outside the confessional to come straight with people and be honest and not put yourself forward. And it'll start working on your character. You know, you get in the habit of just taking responsibility for yourself, and that is going to translate into making you a better person, right? So that's another reason to do it. A reason not to do it would be if you're the sort of person who's just completely overwhelmed with scrupulosity. And you live in this constant state of anxiety of like, what peccadillo did I do? What did I fail to confess? And everything strikes you as a sin and you have no peace of conscience. In that situation, what you need to confess is scrupulosity.
Right.
And submit yourself to the judgment of the priest, who's going to say something like, whatever you do, don't ever bring this up in confession again.
Yeah.
And then you have to avoid the temptation to run to the confessional down the street and bring it up again.
Absolutely. Leslie, thanks so much for your call today from Celeste, Texas. Good to hear from you on EWTN's Call to Communion. One of the great things that we bring you every day on EWTN Radio is Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz, where he guides you through the entire Bible and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in 365 episodes. So if you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you. Check it out tonight and every night at 10 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. We are delighted to bring that to you. It was so very, very popular as a podcast and now on the radio. Just fantastic. Glad that we could be a part of that for you. Do check it out tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN. Here's a question now from Scott watching us on YouTube today. Dr. Anders, are we actually saved already, or are we working on ourselves daily in the hopes of salvation when Jesus returns?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. So, you know, Christ says, Matthew 25, those who persevere to the end will be saved.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me, Matthew 24. Those who persevere to the end will be saved. So in the way that everybody is really interested in knowing, like, where am I going to spend eternity? Well, you have to persevere to the end.
Yeah.
Right? So you won't know that until you get there, right?
Right, right.
But there's another sense in which we can talk about being saved in the present, and it's not the Protestant sense of, you know, I'm saved so I know for sure I'm going to heaven. Not that way. But here's another way. You know, trivially, well, not trivially, but like in a very kind of pedestrian way, you take somebody who's an addict and suffering enormously, and then they get themselves in a 12-step program or whatever, and they get free of their addiction, right? You tell me if there's not a substantial, noticeable difference in their life.
Oh, yeah.
And is it not true that they have been saved from the ravages of alcoholism?
Yeah.
You know, at least it's ongoing ravages. They may have some residual stuff
sure.
they carry with them for a long time. But, I mean, they're out of that lifestyle, and they're moving on, right?
Yeah.
Well, hopefully, if we're converts to the Catholic faith and we're taking our faith seriously, we've all been saved in that sense. You know, St. Paul talks about Romans chapter 7, how he says, you know, there's a law of my mind that agrees with the law of God. Then there's another law in my members. And the two are at war with each other. And I find that I cannot do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death, right? St. Augustine, in his magnificent book that everybody should read, anybody within the sound of my voice should go pick up a copy of Augustine's Confessions. It's like the first autobiography in the history of the Western world and a tremendous work of philosophy. Go pick it up and read it. But he talks about, in this work, how he himself struggled with this concupiscence. And for him, it was sex addiction. And he just couldn't get free of it. And he was a tremendous intellect and a great philosopher, and he read all this wonderful Platonic, Neoplatonic philosophy that really idealized the moral life and talked about the life of the mind and escape from the body, and he thought that sounded great. The problem was he just couldn't do it. He couldn't pull it off. He liked the ethics that he got from Plato and from Plotinus, but he couldn't effectively live it. And he was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then he's at a friend's house. And he's at this guy's house. He picks up, basically off the guy's coffee table, a biography of St. Anthony of the Desert. It was probably Athanasius's biography of St. Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
And he reads it. And Anthony didn't study Neoplatonism. He was illiterate. He never went to school. And yet he and the monks that were around him in the desert had really wonderfully conquered this concupiscence in their lives. They were living victorious, morally superior Christian lives. And Augustine kind of bangs his head against a wall, and he says, how can these men who are illiterate, don't have my education, be beating me black and blue in the moral life?
Yeah.
And you know what was the obvious answer was that they were disciples of Christ. And what made the difference was the Christian faith. And so he says, okay, that's what I got to do. You know, and he goes and he gets a hold of Bishop Ambrose in Milan and learns a bit more about the faith and says, I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to plunge in. He gets baptized, receives communion, starts living a Catholic life, and lo and behold, he gets free of his sex addiction. And he wrote a book about that difference. It was called On True Religion, De Vera Religione. And everybody ought to read that one too, although it's not as good a read as the Confessions. And in On True Religion, he basically says look, Platonism, good stuff. Philosophy, good stuff, right? Problem, no one does it, right? And the world is still mired in sin. But look at what Christ has done among his faithful who have taken the thing seriously.
Yes.
Christianity makes possible the ethic that philosophy only glimpsed. That's essentially his argument in On True Religion. And clearly, he saw himself as having been saved from a life of sin. And it wasn't just that he had to wait till eternity to enjoy the fruits of that. He was enjoying them now, right? And later on in the book, he describes this mystical ascent that he and his mother Monica actually had in a spiritual dialogue where they felt as if their souls were transported to heaven with this longing and anticipation of things above. And he has this sort of hint, this sort of intimation from this experience of transcendence, if you could multiply that times infinity and extend it out everlastingly, what heaven would be like. And he's sort of, you know, touches it with a sigh and then, you know, comes back down to planet Earth. But that kind of mystical ascent would come to characterize his inner life, to fill him with joy and a sense of the truth and the good and the beautiful that was so vastly different from his previous experience of sort of this enfleshed prison house of sin and concupiscence that had so ruled him. Now, did he think that his salvation was assured in the sense that he knew he would go to heaven when he died? No. But he had been saved from his life of sin in the present. had been given intimations of immortality, if I can quote Blake, and a lively hope that the thing could continue for all eternity if only he persevered. So yeah. In that sense, we could say saved now in the hopes of being saved later.
Fantastic. Appreciate that. Scott, thank you so much for your question via YouTube. Let's go now
I'm sorry, that was Wordsworth, not Blake. I was
wondering. Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
right.
Very good. Here is now Ava, a first-time caller from Coral Gables, Florida, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, hello, Ava. What's on your mind today?
Yes, hello, Dr. Anders. I am calling to find out what is the theology behind our relationship with our deceased loved ones who we believe, because of the life that they led on earth, and they, because I know specifically about my mother who died in grace. I recently listened to a sermon from Bishop Barron who said that there is no connection between us and our deceased loved ones in heaven, that once you are once you pass, that individual is in a different state of mind, and they have no connection between anything earthly and us. And I was so disheartened by that,
yes,
that I just wanted to know what the church's stand is on that. And then I took it to the level of saints. Why are we told that we can pray to the saints and that they can intercede for us when they did have a human life here, yet they are in the presence of God?
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So first of all, let me say something about Bishop Barron. I'm very familiar with Bishop Barron's work, and I am totally assured of Bishop Barron's orthodoxy, right? I do not call that into question for a second, because I've read many of his books and heard many of his talks and had an opportunity to meet the man, and I feel quite certain that everything he has said is fully compatible with Catholic orthodoxy, with the Catholic faith. And that would include the good bishop's teaching about the nature of the afterlife and the intercession of the saints on our behalf and so forth. So I feel sure there's some qualification here. There's some context here that we're not picking up,
okay,
that would clarify this. All right. So I'm going to throw out where I think he might have been going, and I'll tell you for sure what the church's teaching is.
Okay.
So here's the absolute skinny on the life of the next world and their relationship to us. They pray for us. And that is emphatically the case. And that is a dogma of the church. The saints in heaven pray for us. To pray for us, they must have consciousness that we exist. It is unintelligible that they could pray for something that they are unaware of. Right?
Sure.
Furthermore, not only do they pray for us, but they offer our prayers. Right. So they have some consciousness that we are praying to them. And then they're in turn translating that into offerings before the throne of Almighty God. That's biblical teaching. Revelation chapter 5 says that the saints offer our prayers as incense before the throne of God. Okay, now that's all dogmatic teaching of the church. What do we not know? And this is the question mark. Okay, how exactly are they conscious of us? How exactly is our prayer made known to them? And here, I would say, this is a matter of speculation. It's not a matter of church dogma. And I'll suggest two different possibilities, both of which are fully possible within the Catholic scheme of things. Okay, one of them is that if I say, for example, St. Augustine, you know, I got a bum knee. Well, you ask Jesus to fix my bum knee, right? That Augustine, you know, as it were, and I'm speaking kind of humorously here, you know, he gets a memo. You know, something comes across the mimeograph machine. He goes, okay, oh, Anders, bum knee. Got that one. Check. God, bum knee. Take care of it, right? It could conceivably work that way, okay? But here's another possibility that I think is just as plausible. Augustine has it in his heart. It is his intention. Something like the following. Dear God, please hear the prayers of all those who seek my intercession. Without necessitating that he have specific historical knowledge of my that particular bum knee on that day,
uh-huh,
right? Either one of them would satisfy the description, he is praying for me and offering my prayers,
mm-hmm,
right? And I don't think the church specifies that it's either one of those, okay? Now, if you look to many private revelations that have come in the history of the church, and we have to be cautious about deriving dogmatic conclusions from private revelations, but in the absence of anything else, it's interesting to speculate, right? In the history of private revelations, there certainly are private revelations where saints and angels interact with humans, you know, this side of the resurrection, and have some very specific content exchanged in terms of, you know, you need to do this, this, and this, and this, and I'll do that, 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 and that. I mean, very intimate engagement. Now, is that exceptional? Is that the norm? Again, we wouldn't be able to conclude that from the revelations themselves, just that it happens, right?
Sure.
So I think we really have to qualify whatever it was that the good bishop intended. We need to set it within that larger Catholic dogmatic framework, which is assured teaching.
Ava, thank you so much for your call today. Dr. David Anders, thank you,
well,
sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We do this program Monday through Friday on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern. Do check it out. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you next time on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.